we have the pleasure of receiving Rafael, who is a student at Stanford and was involved in a very interesting paper, which, of course, we're going to discuss here along this episode. Rafael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Rafael, I have the first question here for you. I just want you to kind of introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and how did you get into this whole area of artificial intelligence, kind of like your background.
Yeah, sure. Very early on, I was always interested in sort of quantitative subjects, mathematics in particular. And, you know, from middle school, high school, I did a lot of math and I went down the mathematics competition route, and Olympiad route, and those type of things. And I wanted, for career-wise, to do things that are very highly quantitative, mathematical, scientific, but also had like certain impact and wasn't sort of like, you know, I kind of felt that pure mathematics in a way was maybe a little bit isolating and, you know, didn't really have the impact on the world, and people necessarily didn't really care about it as much, I guess. So in my undergraduate, I studied applied math and statistics. Then I went to work in finance and quantitative modeling for a few years. Then I decided, you know, I didn't find it as interesting anymore. And again, I felt like the impact I had was very sort of like limited to the companies I worked with. And I wanted to do certain, as I said, broader technical impact things. I came back to graduate school to kind of explore that further. Initially, I kind of like bounced around a little bit. I was like unsure what direction I wanted to work in. I did some computer vision. I did some things in like genomics even. Eventually settled on reinforcement learning type of things, because I think reinforcement learning and decision making is, for several reasons, I think fundamentally they're like the most mathematical, I think like the really most difficult problems in artificial intelligence in a certain way. But also I think they fundamentally embody what artificial intelligence is, intelligent beings, whether, you know, biological or artificial, need to be able to make decisions, need to be able to evaluate decisions, need to be able to do planning, need to be able to sort of like understand the world around them and react in one way or another. Basically started working on reinforcement learning. I used to do a lot of classical reinforcement learning type of things, model-based reinforcement learning, kind of before basically like the last year and a half, kind of the really where really foundation models took off. And once that happened, ROHF or RO things were like a really fundamental component of the success of this new age of foundation models. And that was also kind of like the field I was working on. I had like a lot of experience and basically that transferred naturally and started doing a lot of work on basically decision-making in RO and imitation learning and things like that for foundation models, being language, diffusion, vision language stuff on one hand. And on the other hand, at the same time, interesting enough, there's also this trend of using foundation models for decision making, so particularly like large scale foundation models in robotics. So that's kind of like what I split my time with. Half my time I kind of work on, you know, sort of ROHF problems or sort of decision making foundation models problems, making those better, hopefully. And my other half time is sort of used on how do we use this thing in embodied intelligence and robotics.
Well, and if I may ask a question, where did the idea of DPO came from?
Yeah, so it was kind of like a little bit of a convoluted path. We were particularly working on this project on basically it was a red teaming exercise about language model detection. And the idea there is like, I'm sure you're familiar with language model detectors, where you have text generated language models, you have different methods to detect whether that text is human written or not. And the idea was really simple, whether we can use reinforcement learning to mask a language model and whether, you know, that model becomes undetectable. And the idea there is sort of like, there's always this background of distribution matching and reinforcement learning, sort of like generative adversarial imitation learning, and all this sort of like inverse RL type of background literature, which sort of tells you at the end, the distributions like match, and you cannot distinguish between them. And the whole idea there is like, can we demonstrate this with RL on detection, that like detection of like machine generated text is ultimately not feasible long-term. That was kind of the idea there. And we were using a lot of the classical RL and LLM pipelines. And the interesting thing is that didn't work at all. Not only didn't like improve the model, but actually like diverge quite a bit. And basically that's kind of like, we're starting studying the structure of kind of the ROHF setup a little bit. And in particular, the way it's done, and it's still done this way to a large degree, it's this banded setting where you have a prompt, you know, request from a user or whatever, you have an answer, and then you have like certain quality score at the end of that answer. And when we're trying to do the language generation stuff, we really weren't, the masking stuff, we really weren't getting a lot of signal. And we weren't getting a lot of signal is because when you start generating the text, initially, like, things look plausible, like in human written potentially, but as you generate more, you sort of like fall off that manifold of the human written text into like a machine generated sort of like neighborhood of that text. And by the time you're done generating, you sort of like have very little signal. And then I started fundamentally thinking, was like, how would we do this sort of like almost a guided generation thing where like at each step of your generation, you kind of like try to stay on that manifold, try to not diverge as you by kind of like doing with this PPO stuff. And fundamentally started looking into like this idea of autoregressive kind of like reward models. And basically, if you do the math of the log linearization of basically the optimal policy on a per token basis, you kind of get this optimal equation. And there's kind of core part of the DPO work that there's actually, you know, there's the composition between the optimal model and the, basically like you can represent the optimal model through the base model plus the reward. And at that point, I sort of like realized that this is not actually helping for a problem because it's not feasible to sample from. But it's actually like really nice objective and like has a really nice property if you want to do the classical RHF thing. And basically plug it into classical RHF, and that's how we got the DPO objective. And I just tried it on the sort of like red teaming detection problem I was talking about, and it just sort of like worked out of the box. Like immediately, like, you know, it wasn't even debugging or anything, just like did it, and like the first experiment just worked. And I had spent at this point like probably like a month or so trying to get the classical RL pipeline to work on this problem, and just gotten like virtually zero progress. And the DPO stuff, like literally the first run we tried, and it was like really amazing results. And that's kind of when we know there's sort of like something there, and basically constructed the experiments, started working on trying to scale things up. And basically from that point where like the formulation of the objective, and we submitted to New Rips last year, it was like about 3 weeks we did the whole project essentially.
Cool. Yeah, I think it was a very breakthrough paper. And like, just a small question before I let other people ask, because I'm pretty sure they also have questions, is did you participate in the integration with the Hugging Face team? And if so, how was it? Like, you read published the paper and it was to Hugging Face like weeks after.
Yeah, we actually did work with them quite closely. And there was a lot of back and forth, especially around the training of the Zephyr model and like different parts mm-hmm. of the process. So yeah, I'd say we do interact with them quite closely, and we still talk on a variety of topics.
Yeah, and could you like explain the main difference in practice between supervised fine tuning and the reinforcement learning with human feedback? Like, in which case should we use each one of them?
Yeah, that's actually a very complicated topic. You know, it sounds simple, but there's like a lot hiding underneath that question, to be honest. And there's like a big debate, I think, around right now is like, and it's been going for a little bit. Do we even need that reinforcement learning from human feedback layer? If we have like very high quality data, we have like a lot of data, can we just train on the model on it and just like be done with it? I think there are two answers to that. First of one is sort of like proved by existence. And the answer is like all the strongest models we have right now are using RHF. And even in the open source community, the models do have this additional layer of RHF, mostly DPO, actually. Like, I think classical RHF is not really not really seriously used in the community for a variety of reasons. Okay. They basically all, like, outperform the base tuned models. And I think Chris Matting, you posted this a couple of times, that, like, at some point, 10 out of the top 10 open source models on the Hugging Face leaderboard use DPO for training. And I think we recently checked it again, and now it's 9 out of the top 10 use DPO for training. So empirically, the proof is there that these techniques give you something more. They give you some boost in performance.
Mm-hmm. But from what I understood, DPO is more to align the neuron, the model with your type of answers that you prefer, while supervised fine-tuning is more to give hard knowledge to the model. Or I'm completely wrong?
Again, also like a little bit of complicated answer, I think. I think there are probably varying thoughts on this. My way of thinking is there's like several types of supervised fine tuning. There's the large scale pre-training, in which you're doing unsupervised pre-training on large scale internet text. And in my opinion, I think this is like where the actual knowledge and potential like capabilities of the model come from, of this like large scale pre-training. Then you take this large scale pre-trained model and fine tune it additionally with supervised tuning on a bunch of instruction data. I think that's where sort of the capabilities of the model in terms of like instruction following and formatting and like being able to actually like interact with you come from. And then like the RHF fine tuning part is like a final layer on top of that. XMOR is, I kind of almost see it as autonomous driving, right? Where you have like certain system that gets you like 90% of the data in terms of like perception and like all these things. Then you build the final control stack and all of that stuff. It gets you 95, 96, 97, 98% of the way there, right? And that's supervised fine tuning and instruction tuning. That's basically like the instruct model. And the RHF is really kind of like the last 1 to 2% of capabilities, but really those kind of like autonomous driving are really important, right? Because you cannot have autonomous driving cars at 98% success rate. You need like 99.9. In the same way, I don't think you can really have successful products and like strong models that are sort of like a 98% thing. But if you have like, you need it to be useful. You need them to like follow like user instructions. You need them to be like easy to use. And I think that comes basically from, like a lot of that comes from ROHF. And also like OpenAI basically productionized ChatGPT. Like they had previous instruction models which were not widely productionized as a, you know, as a commercial product, right? Because I think part of that is they're not necessarily like as easy to, you know, they're not as helpful, they're not as compliant, they're not as like easy, they don't necessarily do exactly what you want them to do, etc. All of these things where like they probably have all the same capabilities ChatGPT has, but they're not like necessarily as easy to interact with.
It's probably the capacity of talking to humans and having a conversation that was gained through our LHF, at least what I understood.
Yeah, I think you could probably also talk to the instruct models, and there are instruct models like out there that not RHF that you can probably like, you can talk to them and you can give them tasks for them to do, and they probably do some of it. But I think basically like the quality of the answers and how closely they will follow your instructions are going to be meaningfully lower, and like it would be kind of like meaningfully worse experience as a user of a product without this ROHF pipeline. So this is just in general about the ROHF pipeline, the way it's done in like production analyzing and things like that. I think it's also like a more general question of that you can like autonomously improve your model in any way you want based on the feedback you give it, right? So like we usually the feedback is given to these models are things like, you know, did this like really resolve what I wanted to do? Was this like helpful? Did it like, you know, do what I wanted you to do, and like did it solve the question I asked you? Versus if you can provide feedback in any way, right? You can provide feedback on factuality, and there's a few papers on this actually that you can just give it like this answer has like a hallucination. This answer is true. For example, you can provide that feedback, and by training with the ROHF pipeline, that you actually see improvement in factuality in your model. You can provide feedback based on reasoning, planning, whatever. I guess what I'm trying to say is whatever dimension you provide your feedback to the model, you can improve that dimension of capability and performance of the model with sort of reinforcement learning pipeline. It's just at large scale, at company level scale, things like that, what people have been doing is sort of like providing feedback on from the user perspective, like how good of a product this is, I guess. But all of these other things are feasible. And there probably is also feedback at this at the large companies on like factuality and definitely safety, right? Safety is also like a pretty big part of the ROHF thing. Whatever you want to give it feedback on, like with efficient training, you will improve along that dimension.
Mm-hmm. And Rafael, you mentioned a lot of companies, like even like OpenAI and Hugging Face. Mm-hmm. Not counting Hugging Face, have these guys come to talk to you after you published the paper, like Meta or OpenAI, Google?
Yeah, we've given quite a few talks, actually. I think at this point, we've presented this work almost everywhere. So yeah, we've had conversations. And some of them have also like started adopting these methods. This is not a secret. Like Mistral, like openly in their release, they said they're using DPO for their ROHF phase, for example. So yeah, we've been talking to a lot of people. And, you know, even Meta, I think the Llama 2 pipeline was already in place when this came out, but they've actually done a decent amount of work actually on using the DPO algorithms and like pushing them forward. I don't know if you've seen their self-improvement, the self-critique work they did. So yeah, I think we've seen a lot of work. We've seen big companies. We've already seen some big companies adopt this as a productionized version. We've also seen like a lot of research come out of big companies on these methods. I think at this point, there's probably like 5 papers out of DeepMind on DPO basically. So yeah, we're definitely seeing a lot of interest and a lot of engagement from the big companies as well.
Well, that's going to be pretty exciting. Now, when you're training a model, let's say a model related to text, right? You can do many things with it. You can ask it to come up with something or maybe summarize something or create something new from pre-existing text, the classic sentiment analysis. So are there situations in which DPO is more efficient than in other situations, or is it sort of homogeneous across the board?
So I don't think it's actually like the answer to the question, I don't think this is depending on the algorithm. I think what DPO does is just like makes the whole ROHF fine-tuning phase very efficient and very easy to do from an algorithmic perspective. But I think the core answer to your question is like it really depends on the data, on like how much data you have, how good your data coverage is, how high quality your data is, and things like how on policy your data is. This is something we don't really talk about, I think, enough in the open source community, is that how relevant your feedback is to your model, I think is like really important to the improvement of the model you have. Let me give you a quick example here. So for example, think about some factuality thing, right? You know, you can ask the model some general world factoid currently, say like, you know, who's the president of the United States, and says, the president of the United States is Joe Biden, which is true. And now imagine that you instead you have a pair of feedback, which is like, who's the president of the United States? And you have two answers, which the preferred answer is Joe Biden. The rejected answer, Kaskarachev, is say like Barack Obama, right? So you have like a lot of, you can have like a lot of feedback on that. But if you kind of look at it, this piece of feedback is really useless because the model already knows that the president is Joe Biden. Like, it doesn't care about that piece of feedback because like it's not really giving it corrections or giving it new information. It already knows. It's already correct. So like that feedback is not necessarily like relevant to it. So I think this is the important kind of like direction. It's not the algorithm. It's the data. How good your data is, how wide your coverage your data is, and how relevant your data is to your model and to the task you want to do. I think that's interesting, particularly in the open source community, because basically across the board, we use static offline data sets that were pre-collected by other models, judged by other models to train completely unrelated models. So it's not at all clear, I think, in my mind, how relevant a lot of that feedback is and how useful a lot of that feedback is for when you're training a new model. Unlike the big technology companies who are like, they are getting feedback on their models. Like when you go and interact with the UI and you give it a thumbs up or thumbs down, or like you're getting comparisons, they're getting direct feedback to what they're deploying, and they can fine tune on that direct feedback. So I think that's one like pretty significant difference that, between say open source and the big companies, that, you know, I think it makes a lot of difference being able to get relevant feedback for your model.
On DPO, do you see any improvement like in the near future that you would like to propose, or other people may propose that you see an improvement there?
Yeah, so there's this fair amount of work around this, I think, currently, and people have proposed different algorithms. Like, you know, there's many versions of this algorithm now floating out there. Currently, I don't think I've seen things that fundamentally move the needle, but I've seen... So one of the things, like, in work we're currently doing is sort of, like, on progress is basically related to this off-policy, offline issue I was talking about, where, you know, you have all this feedback that's on there, like, relevant to your model, and it's kind of, like, static. So you're training your model, but you don't know how your model changes. You cannot get like feedback for your model. And what we're actually seeing is there's actually a certain degree of, interestingly enough, there's a certain degree of exploitation similar to classical ROHF. And that can, at the best case, we're seeing that like with your standard training, you're not taking full advantage of the quality of the feedback you have. And under like worse conditions, you can even make your model worse. And I think there's like really interesting, possibly like a whole like little line of research to be done on things like robustness and things like out of distribution sort of exploitation and things like that on the family of DPO algorithms. And I think we were actually like starting to think about this a little bit because we've seen all these papers come out. I think in the last 3 or 4 papers who said like DPO with online feedback or things like spin and all of these things, they're basically sort of like trying to get some continuous training loop happening, and they show improvement over the static training data set. And basically, I think what they're really getting at is this problem of like when you have static data, you're not getting all policy feedback. Your model is like potentially like moving in some direction that's like not relevant to the data, or it's exploiting too much out of distribution. And the way I don't think they're realizing that's what's happening, but the way they've been fixing it is sort of being able to provide on policy feedback, either through like self-supervised learning or through like AI feedback, a lot of these things, or and papers I'm thinking about is like the rejection sampling optimization paper, for example. It's adaptive DPO. It's a continual DPO paper. There's like a paper from DeepMind on online AI feedback with DPO. So all of them basically like do this thing where they find some way to give you like continuous feedback on policy for your model. And think about fundamentally that the problem solves is this like offline training and exploitation that has not been even like formulated correctly yet. So I'm kind of working a lot on formulating that problem. And then once we have formulated the problem, I think there's a lot of work to be done to robustly solve that problem. And that work has been doing a lot in classical RHF over the last 6 months, sort of the exploitation and reward hacking problem in classical RHF. I think really came into the forte about a year ago with a major paper by OpenAI on reward scaling loss for reward optimization. And since then, we've seen a lot of work on rectifying basically these effects that like OpenAI was pointing out in terms of like robustness and out of distribution bootstrapping, you know, these things in the classical RHF pipeline. That problem, as I'm saying, has not been studied in direct alignment algorithms, not just DPO, but IPO, Slick, you know, Cringe, whatever. And first of all, we need to formalize that problem, and that problem exists. Like, you know, we've seen this now. And once we formalize it, I think there's the equivalent literature that we can build on direct alignment algorithms that has been happening on classical RHF, on robustness and algorithm distribution bootstrapping. So I think that's one area of inquiry that I think could really help performance and boosting. And one particular example, as I said, this I was working on this late last night, is, for example, we saw like length exploitation. Under DPO, interestingly enough, all human preference data sets actually have a small length bias, preference bias. And that's kind of like why GPT-4 and all these models are, for example, like very verbose, because like humans do have bias for longer answers. And interestingly enough, we saw this, we're seeing this with DPO as well, where the DPO models become like overly verbose. And there's a very interesting graph we shared with Peter Liu on Twitter recently, where it's like you get like the automated evaluation metrics on the y-axis and length on the x-axis. You kind of see like, you know, improvement on strong open source models where they can match a lot of the closed models on absolute performance. But on a length corrected basis, they're like half in terms of performance. And basically like his point was that, you know, GPT-4 has like all these known like verbosity preferences, and what all these models are doing, they're like hacking that preference. And we worked on this, and we basically sort of had this like regularized version of DPO we just worked on. And for example, on a length corrected basis, we can boost performance by 15 to 20%. So we're just basically like starting to crack that problem of like, you know, offline training and exploitation and bootstrapping. And we even like in the first pass, it's like simple like verbosity, we're also seeing like huge gains. And I think just if we take a serious like stab at the robustness work on RHF, I think there's a lot to be gained there as well.
You mentioned that it was a 3-week thing, right? Since you arrived, that actually you ran into DPO sort of by accident during that red teaming exercise until you actually released the paper. But what I wanted to know is, what was the reaction of the community when you issued the paper? Was it something that you saw DPO be adopted right away across the community? Or were they a little bit uncertain to step away from the classic RLHF training?
Yeah, as I said, we basically like from the model, from the point, you know, derived the objective to the point we submitted the paper is about 3 weeks, essentially. When we submitted the paper and, you know, it came out, I think there was not, you know, there's some reaction, but it's nothing like too, you know, people are like okay with it. I think, so basically, I think also why DPO hadn't happened before in like prior works and such is that OpenAI had been doing this classical RHF pipeline for several years, and they spent a lot of time perfecting it. They spent a lot of time on this to really get it right, because it's such a key component of the productionalizing of these models. And I think the community was like really focused on this and really like, this is the way to do it. You know, they weren't like really thinking outside of the box, so to say. And I think there was like a lot of skepticism about things that weren't that, just because like OpenAI does it, they've been doing it for years, they've been perfecting it, must work, that must be the way, I feel like, was a lot of the feeling that existed about 6 months ago. So I think, and then DPO wasn't the first algorithm that sort of tries to go away from actually the whole RHF pipeline. There were a couple of things before that. I would argue they were like less principled. So they were like a little bit more of an ad hoc methods and didn't work as well for those reasons. But even they weren't generating like a ton of interest. So it was a little bit of a slow burn to get the community interested. I think when it really took off is basically like when Hugging Face took an interest in this, and we kind of collaborated and worked with them, and they did the Zephyr model and like showed like great performance and like really strong improvement there, versus I think at this point, the open source community was not really able to get the RHF pipeline going and wasn't really able to do RHF right and get good performance out of RHF. And then Hugging Face did Zephyr, and like, it was like fast and easy and simple, and they got like significant boost in performance. And that point, I think that got like people really interested. And when things like really like started changing, as basically like the Mistral team basically picking up DPO and training like the Mistral media, and well, the Mixtral models were explicitly trained with DPO. They don't say how the train is to medium, but I'm assuming it's basically like the same pipeline probably. And basically like they had this like strong results, like really competitive models, and they use these algorithms. At this point, I think it's like really we got the buy-in from the broad community and like from bigger companies as well. And it's sort of, it's like a, you know, what is it saying? At first, like first slowly and then suddenly, right? Like we had like several steps to get things going. We had like the buy-in from Hugging Face, which took a little bit of time and took like back and forth, and then we had the buy-in from Mistral. And at this point, when it's like everyone is doing it and everyone's using it, so it's like, you know, it's exponential interest at this point. So yeah, I think basically it did require some work and it requires some back and forth to get buy-in from the community. But yeah.
Philippe asked you a little bit about how you see things going from now on when it comes to DPO. I want to make a more of a broader question and ask you, what have you been seeing that's been exciting that maybe people listening to the podcasts should be paying attention as well when it comes to, I don't know, model training or even machine learning, AI as a whole?
Yeah, so I've been saying this for a few months now. I don't know if it's too relevant, but in my mind, language models are the past, multimodal is the present, and agents are the future. So I think multimodality, multimodal capability, like as you've seen everything coming out, is going to be like really key, and it's like really going through a boom right now. So we've been really working along those axes. We've developed DPO for vision and language models, basically like using human feedback to align modalities and ground language generation within vision. So things like GPT-4V type of thing with like Llama type of things. And we've got like really strong results out of that. On this paper we're releasing soon, we've managed to reduce visual hallucinations by more than half. So it's like, and you know, it's like, and this is like still from random academic effort. We were trying to do proof of concept, not try to like really train at scale. And even with like a small data set, small training effort, we boost Llama 1.5, which at the time was sort of state of the art, by, you know, reduce more than half of the hallucinations. If you just like 5x that effort, I think you can go down to 5% hallucinations or something. Like remove 95 of them or something. We've got really strong results there. Another paper that I think is really flying under the radar, but I think it's like really great piece of research that we did, is DPO for diffusion models. So text-to-image diffusion models. So we took SDXL, like Stable Diffusion XL, and we took the PikaPik dataset, which is like a public dataset of human feedback on image generation. We developed a whole other algorithm for direct RHF on those things, which in name is similar. It has the same name, basically. But as an algorithm, as a derivation, as a mathematical thing, it's like quite different because the diffusion process is quite different than autoregressive generation. Like in diffusion, you could all estimate likelihoods directly, for example. So you can't like do the same thing. We have to like come up with a whole different pipeline, a whole different concept of things. But we did it, and it works, and it's surprisingly good. I really recommend you go see that paper. It's not only you get like a lot of boosting performance over the base model in terms of human evals, but we did things like, you know, there's all these annoying artifacts of diffusion, like messed up hands, like mismatched eyes, wrong teeth. A lot of these things just go away. Like people in the human data set, people are really annoyed by that. So they really downvote those things. And they're like very prominent in the downvotes on the data. So like when you do it, train with RHF, it just goes away. You get like this very natural, like looky hands and like aligned teeth and all of these things. And in blind human evals, actually with this open source work, with, you know, open source models, open source data, we match and even like slightly outperform Midjourney with like this RHF training. So that's, I think it's been like a really strong result that I think community is like still not fully come around to like appreciating and seeing. So yeah, that's one thing. And I think just trying to keep and continue building out the modalities. I think things like music generation and voice are really prime for human in the loop / RHF / alignment. There's a music RL paper just came out from Google like a week ago. They use classical RL, classical RHF. But, you know, this is a prime use case for DPO and all these algorithms as well. We don't have the data publicly, unfortunately, but, you know, there's very clear value. And they show, like, significant improvement in human likes and, like, engagement from music generation. That's another thing. And the obvious next big thing is video. And I think video is particularly interesting because it actually would require the development of even new algorithms. So it's sort of an autoregressive model type of DPO stuff within diffusion, like spatial type of like standard image diffusion. We have to now like, you know, start thinking about like, how do we do alignment and like human in the loop feedback for video generation, which is sort of both like a spatial and temporal component. I think that's kind of like a really exciting direction. It's a little bit hard to study because video is slow, hard to generate, the data is limited, and all the good models are like behind doors, like closed doors now. But I think it's like a pretty exciting step. And another point to add is actually a lot of these diffusion works, classical RHF like has really struggled. And it's like really hard to get it right because first of all, the complexity and everything, but it requires full on data generation. And that's like in language, it's painful, but like in diffusion and like image generation, video generation, it's like exponentially more painful. And I think, for example, this diffusion DPO paper we did, I think sort of leapfrogged the entire ROHF stuff. Like in language, ROHF, classical ROHF came first, and we were sort of like a contender trying to like match that. In the image space and the diffusion space, basically like, we, you know, there were some ROHF efforts and they were like very nascent. We did this DPO on sort of like an order of magnitude better than everything else that existed. And only recently has classical ROHF tried to catch up with what we're doing in diffusion, I think. But it's been kind of hard and it's become pretty expensive for them to do it. I think similar things we play with video. I think like doing classical type of ROHF for videos is going to be a really painful process that's not really going to scale anything. The way to do it and like sort of the most promising approach to sort of the human in the loop alignment for these things is going to be something like more offline, like DPO basically.
This diffusion model open source? Like, did you publish them on Hugging Face?
Yeah. It's all public. The code base has actually been integrated with the diffusers library already. So you can find like the re-implementation of the code, like all public. SDXL is public. The dataset is public. And we released some of the checkpoints as well, I think. So you can play with all these things.
Cool. And how do you feel being in academia right now with this kind of battle between academia and like big techs that they publish nothing, almost nothing about their models, no data, sometimes not even the paper?
Yeah, honestly speaking, I think it's like a really difficult time to be in academia. And I think a lot of people are questioning their role in academia and the place of academia in general. Being totally frank, it has been somewhat frustrating trying to do research in an academic setting because we really don't have the, you know, forget resources. We don't really have the access to certain things to even be able to like study them. You know, there's like so many things that we're potentially interested in. We can like even get the setups. Like, right, for example, one idea is like we're thinking a lot about personalization. How do we do personalization? But we don't have access to
feedback.
We don't have access to individual users. We cannot evaluate individual users, right? And I've been talking to a lot of companies that actually do that, are in that sort of market, and they're like very actively doing that research, very actively deploying a lot of these ideas that I've discussed with them. And they work, surprisingly. Well, not surprisingly, but they actually do work. But at the same time, they're not willing to publish. And they're not willing to share like results. And from an academic perspective, we cannot even like study these things. So like a lot of this research is not even possible to do in academia is one direction, I think. And that I think that is valuable research, especially having that research in the open versus behind closed doors is valuable. The other thing is definitely like also the resource stuff where we're academically under-resourced. There was like basic compute as compared to even like many startups. And I think that fundamentally bottlenecks the pace of development you can do. Like, you know, research doesn't rarely works in the way that's like I described, where it's like we just tried it and it worked the first time, right? There's like certain iteration of exploration, failing, trying different things. Like it could be like a bad luck where you like run like the verges or something. It's like not your algorithms, but just kind of like deep learning, right? And just having the capability of like, let me just kick off these 20 things and see like where it lands and like what the landscape is. It's like very valuable. Being able to iterate fast and being able to do things with even like a little bit of scale is very valuable to evaluate ideas and quickly iterate on ideas. And that's something that's really hard to do in an academic setting right now. So that's been kind of frustrating. And we do have this, as you're saying, this thing where like we're trying to do research in academic setting, but you know we're really sort of like you know don't have the action trying to catch up with like you know a lot of academic research has been like what has OpenAI done like a year ago, right? And we're trying to catch up and do what OpenAI has been doing with like 100 of the resources or something like that.
Do you intend to stay in academia? Because I mentioned that now you might have a lot of offers.
Yeah, I said like, you know, I've expressed a certain amount of frustration with how things are in academia. I think I would like to keep my options open and see how things go. I would fundamentally still like to be able to do research in the open, but unfortunately, I think this is becoming like harder and harder to do in machine learning. So that's kind of like what I'm looking for personally right now, being able to do the research I want to do and being able to have certain amounts of scale and being able to study the problems that matter, but doing it in an open way with like, you know, sharing results and insights and basically doing science in a way. But as I said, I think this is like getting progressively harder to do, unfortunately.
Yeah.
If you guys have any, you know, any tips or anything, I'll be...
Or Hugging Face, because you will still be able to do your own research and public everything. Maybe not Mistral in a while, because I think they started on fully open source and they will close and close over time. But Hugging Face, I think they're going to stay on open source forever because this is their business.
Yeah, I agree. I've had a lot of conversations with them and I think they're a great company, but at the same time, their business model is like a little bit different, right? They're they're trying to make things open and accessible to people, but they're not trying to necessarily like push the limit of what's possible, right? That's they're not trying to be like, you know, let's make an agent that can like rival OpenAI's or Google's or whatever. That's not their goal and it's not their business, right? So yeah, I don't think they're a great company. It's just not what they do, right?
What you said just now reminded me, I think it was Fei-Fei Li that said that if you add up the whole compute power of academia across the US, you don't get what maybe a Meta or an OpenAI has just for them, right? So I don't think I've ever heard actually anybody from academia saying, oh, I've got everything I need, I'm covered, I've got all the resources I wanted. But what you're telling us is that it's actually getting worse instead of being something that you sort of walked into knowing what to expect. And that's kind of worrisome, right?
Yeah, and I guess like the biggest worry for me is like, I think this trajectory might just continue. Like I do see like a potential future where machine learning is something like aerospace engineering, where you know you have, you know, the big, you know, have like NASA or something, and you have the big aerospace companies, Lockheed Martin and something. They're really the ones doing research and development and like building things. And academic setting is like, from what I can tell, is basically just trying to like essentially mostly train people to do these jobs and not necessarily like pushing things further. And like one fear I have, I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but one fear I have is like, this is where like machine learning research ends up being, where it's really the industry doing things that matter and that push the envelope, and we're like sort of like academic institutions kind of like left behind in a little bit in a way to, you know, basically do very peripheral stuff. And I hope that doesn't happen. I hope this is not kind of like the end case, but I definitely see that this is a possibility.
But do you think that the future is those huge models? Because I believe that through time, we're going to decrease the size of the models.
Yes and no. I think fundamentally, you do need certain amount of... So there's like a whole movement to making models smaller, making them more practical. But that movement is not necessarily because of capability or intelligence. That movement is because of resource constraints and limitations and commercialization, right? Like being able to put things on device, being able to run inference at a certain cost, right? But these things are not smarter. They're not getting more capabilities or something. Just like, how do we make this as efficient as possible without making it too much worse, right? I think to actually really, I think there are definitely emergent properties of what's happening at scale that don't happen at small scale, right? And I've talked to a lot of researchers that are doing certain type of research and doing certain type of like development without saying too much. And basically the feedback I'm getting is, yes, this happens, but only happens like 100 plus billion parameters or something. And we've seen these results, and we were excited about these results, but we only saw them at like 100 plus billion parameters. And that's one question. But I think another question is, it's not even just the size of the models anymore. I think there's also, I think compute and the size of models can be decoupled in a way. So being able to have a smart model, but do like more meaningful things with a smart model, being able to do things like planning at scale and being able to use your model to do search at scale. And that is sort of like fundamentally decoupled from how big your model is, right? You can, like, what is the saying? There's like two things that scale infinitely with like computing data. It's like deep learning and search, right? And basically, if you kind of, I think it's all basically, you know, this is kind of clear that like on this agentic future, that's where things are going, right? It's like trying to combine these two things. So in a, you know, that's all the speculation of what Q-star was, right? So it's not actually just the size, but it's other compute constraints as well.
Because I believe that like smaller and specialized models, they're gonna replace those huge models for specific applications, especially like in a product level when we're not talking about this huge OpenAI, Google, but like in a small startup, we need way more specialized models than these huge LLMs.
Yeah, I mean, I agree to some degree, but this is still like a resource constraint, right? Like AGI is not gonna be 7 billion, right?
Yeah. Rafael, thank you very much for your time. I think people are going to love this episode. If folks want to continue this conversation directly with you, where should they go?
Just email me at my Stanford email, or also I spend a lot of time on Twitter these days, so just like message me on Twitter. So either of those works, or I guess it's X now. So
yeah, well, I'll leave those links in the description. Thank you.